libraries in the country and the oldest in the city. Founded in 1754, a group of civic-minded people were intent on creating, quote, a public library that would be very useful as well as ornamental to the city. The library, in the intervening 263 years, is one of the city's enduring institutions. Please support its wide-ranging and ongoing services and programs. I'm Jenny Lawrence, a former trustee and longtime member of the library, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce Ian Toll this evening. Ian graduated from Georgetown in 1989 and went on for a master's at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Early in his career, he was a political aide and speechwriter to United States Senator Paul Sarbanes and New York Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen. He then was an analyst at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and an equity research analyst at three investment banks covering communications, software, and e-commerce stocks. Then his career completely changed. I think they'll tell us what turned him to naval history, specifically how, quote, a handful of bastards and outlaws fighting under a piece of striped bunting, end quote, humbled the omnipotent British Navy. This resulted in a book published in 2006 about the epic founding of the U.S. Navy during the War of 1812. Next, he waded chest deep into the monumental subject of the Pacific War, the Allied and Japanese sides of the conflict, the home fronts and the battle fronts, the highest levels of political and military leadership, and the perspectives from the decks, trenches, and cockpits. In Volume 1, The Pacific Crucible, published in 2011, he covers the first 6 months of the Pacific War, from Pearl Harbor to Midway, when the Japanese juggernaut, quote, brought the vast Pacific Empire under the flag of the rising sun, end quote. Ian's subject tonight, Volume 2, covers the heart of the Pacific War between 1942 and 1944, quote, when parallel Allied counteroffensives north and south of the equator washed over Japan's far-flung empire like a conquering tide, end quote. Despite its heft, a 622-page paperback weighs in at 2+ pounds. The book is a page-turner, even cinematic. The scale is massive, a theater of war that encompassed a fifth of the world. It's said that it takes a generation to forget the past. Now, more than 70 years since the war's end, we have more than a generation to forget. But Ian does not let us forget the war's vast scope, the costs and destruction and displacement of people, resources, and nations, and, most important, particular stories. His research is astonishing. His sweeping overviews and then deep dives into the immediate make history come alive. Please join me in welcoming Ian Toll.
Thank you very much for that very kind introduction. And, I'm very happy to be here. I have done some research in this library. In fact, just now when I was upstairs purportedly going over my speech notes, I felt, you know, it gets in the blood when you do this for a living, and I felt the gravitational pull of the catalog terminal. I sat myself down and started to go through the sources that I still want to consult, which is always fruitful because you never know what you'll find when you start that process, when you sit down in a good library with an interesting and diverse collection. You're bound to find something, and often the most valuable thing you find won't be what you're looking for. And that has been my experience here and in many other libraries and archives around the country as I've researched the subject. Of course, there is another problem, which is that you can do too much research, and that has been my problem historically with all of the books that I've taken on, and it continues to be actual deadline for the third volume of this trilogy was December 31st of last year. And as of right now, I owe my editor a phone call, which I have been putting off for the last few weeks. The good news is that if you contract with a New York publishing house to do a trilogy, and they publish the first two books of that trilogy, then you sort of have them in a bind. They're not going to back out of the contract. But the bad news is that that can become part of the reasoning that allows me to continue to not write or to write too slowly. Today I was working on chapter one of my book. The good news is that I also have quite a bit written in later chapters as well, but I've been going over this chapter again and again and again. I think I've re-outlined it now 9 times. I've got, I think, about 450 pages written, which feels like a real accomplishment, but when you realize that this chapter really needs to be taken down to 40 pages, you realize it's almost easy to throw all those 450 pages out and start again. So that's a glimpse into the kinds of problems that I'm dealing with and have been dealing with today. I love to write, but I also love to come and talk a little bit about my work. I feel a little bit like a bear coming out of a cave after a long winter's hibernation, squinting into the sunlight, and yet looking forward to that first snack down at the river. First principles, why study war at all? Why go through this eclectic career that you've heard a little bit about, and then spend 15 years writing about war? Well, a Jesuit professor at Georgetown told me it's really quite simple. If you ask the question, why has human history been so bloody? You don't need to pull philosophy or theology into it. War is bloody because men like to fight. Men love war. Women, not as much. But watch a group of 11-year-old boys at play. The old nursery rhyme that girls are made of sugar and spice and everything nice, boys are made of snips and snails and puppy dogs' tails. Well, I think that there's some truth in that. I'm the father of a 13-year-old boy. And watching him and his friends put on a play a few years ago, they were, I think, maybe first grade. They were all upstairs. The parents were downstairs. We were having wine. They were playing upstairs. They came downstairs and they said, "We've written a play. We want to perform it for you. So come upstairs." Of course, we're all proud and excited, and we go upstairs. This play, I think, was 5 or 6 acts, and every act was the same. The kids would come out onto the stage, and they had all of the toy weapons from different eras, swords and guns and muskets and knives, and there was no dialogue at all. And they would have a big fight, and then everyone would, it was like the last scene of Hamlet 4 or 5 times in a row. So I'm not about to wade into the nature versus nature debate about gender identity, but I do think that there's something to the idea that if women ran the world, we would have a lot less bloodshed. So I think a military historian has to be very careful to avoid wandering into the trap, which is very common, to slip into the mode of glorifying war for its own sake, honor the extraordinary courage and sacrifice of warriors who have fought for our country, for great causes. But keep before you always the fact that war is inherently tragic, whether just or necessary. It is always a great tragedy. One reason, I think, to study and record the history of war is to understand better the nature of the societies that fight it. I, until recently, lived in San Francisco in the Marina District, and I could walk to the Golden Gate Bridge, and often did from my apartment. And on the pedestrian walkway up to the bridge, there is a public artwork, or I suppose you would call it an exhibit. And what this is a lattice beam of the same type that holds up the bridge on its southern end. And it has been crushed and bent. And when you read the captions, they explain to you that what was done was that this beam was taken to Berkeley, where at the Berkeley School of Engineering, the engineers placed it into an enormous machine about three stories high and placed 4 million tons of pressure on it in order to test it, in order to see whether it was good. In this case, although it was crushed, it stood up well enough, which would give you some confidence if you live in San Francisco and you're driving across that bridge. The Berkeley engineers did to that beam is what war does to nations, societies, systems of government. World War II was, in a sense, a struggle between two competing visions of how to organize a society. The fascist and militarist authoritarian states of the Axis went to war with the proposition that their form of government, of organizing society, was inherently stronger than that of the democracies, where the collective strength of the democracies would be frittered away with their internal disputes, with their divided systems of government, with their checks and balances. Of course, what World War II showed was that the democracies, once aroused, were stronger and also more rational than the fascist and authoritarian models. I have spent quite a bit of time and attention in the current volume, when I'm writing, paying attention to the issues of media, press, propaganda, and politics, because I believe that this aspect of World War II, and I think it's axiomatic really of all military history, has been neglected. And in some cases has been neglected in ways that have significantly impaired our understanding of the subject. I think there are a number of reasons for that. It partly has to do with the fact that many who write military history are simply not that interested. It, I think, also can be explained by the fact that many influential writers of military history have been affiliated with the Army, the Navy, either as civilians or as uniformed officers, and have felt a professional constraint against writing about these areas. This is a kind of forbidden fruit. A professional military officer isn't supposed to comment on these subjects, and yet in war so often, you have a convergence of military strategic decision-making with political considerations. And I would argue that in our history, that probably was never more true than in the case of the Pacific War, where partly due to the great fame and political popularity and influence of General Douglas MacArthur, who became a media superstar really in the first month of the war, at a time when the mass media had grown much larger and more powerful in the United States than it ever was before, when radio, which was a relatively new medium, had allowed voices to be broadcast directly into American homes, when the moving image had become much more important because of newsreels, and was about to become even more important in the post-war period because of television. For all of these reasons, the Pacific campaign became highly politicized in a way that many historians, I think, have neglected or have conveniently forgotten. The last year of the Pacific War, in a theater in which you had divided authority, command authority, between the Navy and the Army, with the Pacific Fleet under the command of Admiral Chester Nimitz, north of the equator, and MacArthur Supreme in the south, with two giant competing amphibious aerial naval offensives coming into a convergence in the last year of the war. Some of the most complex decision making that was faced by the Allied side in the Second World War. The time when it was clear that we were going to win that war. There was no question, in fact, in a sense, we had already beaten the Japanese by the summer of 1944. And yet, how to finish this war in a way that would contain American losses, that would bring us the quickest victory, and that would also secure American and Allied interests in a post-war order in Asia. All of this taking place in 1944, which is, of course, presidential election year. And our democracy is really different from most other democracies in the world in many ways, but in one way that's particularly important is that we have no means of postponing elections. Our elections are locked into a schedule, have been since our Constitution was ratified in 1789. So postponing or delaying elections was never a possibility, as it wasn't written. And lo and behold, Douglas MacArthur willingly engaged in a dark horse campaign for the Republican nomination in 1944, an episode in which in his post-war memoirs, he talks about them as if there was some sort of an annoying subplot that he barely knew about. And once he heard about it, he immediately put an end to it. Historians and biographers have since showed that despite the fact that he and his kitchen cabinet and supporters were careful to avoid leaving a paper trail, in fact, MacArthur very willingly engaged in what I think was a somewhat disgraceful attempt to try to pressure Washington by essentially threatening to challenge the sitting president of the United States in a wartime election. All of that, of course, it's a long, sordid story. I've got, as I told you, many hundreds of pages written about it, but I think it's important to try to weave these different strands into the analysis of what was happening in the Pacific. But why another history of the Pacific War? There's a certain amount of World War II fatigue, and I understand that. In fact, I even share that sentiment. I was in New Orleans last year for the 75th anniversary of the attack on Pearl Harbor last December, speaking at the National World War II Museum, and I riding in from the airport, I had a chatty cab driver, and he asked me what I did for a living. I said, well, I'm working on a book about World War II. And without asking any other questions, he said, well, hasn't that book already been written? Kind of had me there. You know, the question people ask, and it's a good question, certainly a very fair question, is what's new? What do you have that's new? And people ask this, even people who haven't read a single book about World War II, because they know that it's received an immense amount of attention. Well, part of my problem is that it's not that I can't answer that question, it's that I can't answer it inside of about 3.5 hours. It's a lot of different things that are new, and some of them are somewhat subtle, right? I don't have an elevator pitch down to answer that. But in general, I would say that I think that there has been a trend in World War II scholarship where we have had a tendency towards specialization. Of course, that can be very powerful. You have people focusing on individual subjects, biographies. In the Naval War, you have ship histories. You have deeper and better accounts of individual battles. You have all sorts of various subjects and incidents. And of course, the size of the literature grows at the same time it becomes much richer, but also more piecemeal. And at its best, I think this approach deepens our collective understanding of the subject, but it also results in an overall landscape with this scholarship in which we have a lack of broader narratives that pull these themes together, and that's what I've set out to do. Military history has been treated somewhat as a subgenre, and even somewhat of a ghetto, I think, hermetically sealed off from other important aspects of history, and I've touched on these themes already. It has been neglected generally in the halls of academia, which I think is a mistake, potentially based on the idea that to study something is to glorify it. At the same time, World War II and military history in general tends to be what they call in this town in the publishing industry highly marketable. Now, there's an audience for military history. People buy these books and read them. And because there's an audience for military history, the big publishing houses tend to publish it. They're responding to a market signal. And because they're, at least in a relative sense, more willing or eager to publish these titles, they lower the bar, I think, a little bit in terms of what they'll take, the quality. And what that means is that you have a lot of drag. I'm sorry to say it, but there has been a lot of work in World War II that really adds very little to what exists. So that's what I've set out to do. I remember a review of my first book, Six Frigates, generally a friendly review. The reviewer sounded one note, one slightly critical note, and she said, "Told Cadwell strays out of his lane a little bit." And I love that. I love that image. Because I absolutely do stray out of my lane. I think the stay in your lane mentality has been somewhat of a straitjacket in this field. Naval history has been treated as a subgenre of the subgenre of military history. Much of it written, as I've said, by scholars affiliated directly with the U.S. Navy. But the Pacific War has larger dimensions. Clausewitz, probably the most famous thing ever said about war. The war is a continuation of politics by other means. On our type of government, politics can be a continuation of war by other means. FDR used to tell a joke, and to his credit, he told a joke about himself. And there are a couple of Marines at Henderson Field in Guadalcanal in 1942, and one of them says, the original version of the joke is, "I can tell you how to get a job." I won't say that, I'll say, "I can tell you how to kill a Japanese soldier. What you do is you walk up that hill and you shout, 'To hell with Hirohito, Emperor of Japan.'" And there's a Japanese soldier up there who is so will be so enraged that he'll come charging out of the bush after you and you can shoot. And so the Marine walked up the hill and he shouted, "To hell with Hirohito." Louder, "To hell with Hirohito." And the Japanese soldier popped his head up out of the bush and said, "To hell with FDR." And so the Marine slung his rifle over his shoulder and he walked back down the hill. And his friend said, "Well, what happened? I didn't hear a shot." And he said, "Well, I know we're supposed to win this war, but I'm not going to shoot another Republican." So the politics, the diplomacy involved in these big decisions in the Pacific, the management of a global allied coalition, the social history, the propaganda, the organization of the economy for war production, the planning for the post-war future, all of these important subjects are usually omitted in histories and narratives about the war. The question of how, when, and how aggressively to fight the Pacific War within the context of this global campaign was always at the highest levels of our politics and became an issue in the electoral politics of the congressional election in 42 and the presidential election in 1944. It was at the heart of our Anglo-American negotiations. As Eisenhower said, there really wasn't any controversy over our decision to make Europe the principal focus of the Second World War. Europe first principle, the idea that we would load up most of our assets to defeat Nazi Germany first, before turning the full weight of our military might against Japan. But there was never, I think as Eisenhower put it, as far as he knew, the logic of that global strategy has never been questioned by any real student strategy. And like so much of what our military leaders wrote during and after the war, this was a not too subtle shot at another officer, Douglas MacArthur, who Eisenhower knew very well and cordially despised. And MacArthur returned the same of interest. But MacArthur alone, really, among the major military leaders, Allied military leaders in the Second World War, did not accept the logic of Europe first. All of this played into the future of Western colonialism in Asia, specifically the end of Western colonialism. And it was an ideological struggle played out between Japan's pan-Asian liberation ideology and the competing concepts of the universal principles of democracy and self-determination. So all of this, I think, first of all, I find the subject to be inherently interesting, but secondly, I think that in so many cases when you're trying to understand these very big consequential decisions that were made in 1944, 1945, it is absolutely essential to try to weave these different strands into what is too often a purely military strategical sort of analysis. I believe in the narrative style of history. I believe in a style of history that combines a certain kind of scholarly rigor with a storytelling sensibility. I try to write these books because these are the books that I like to read, and always have, since I first really became hooked on history at age about 12 or 13. We're in a library that you can wander the stacks. There's no shortage of histories written about almost every subject, but I continue to believe that authors who really manage to get this balance right, to do justice to these subjects while maintaining the propulsive momentum of a good story, those types of histories are as rare as a unicorn. The scholar's approach of stating a thesis, marshaling evidence, restating the thesis in light of the evidence, this approach has real power. It has led to some of our deepest insights in history. And as Gordon Wood once said to me, popular historians depend on academic historians, while the reverse is not necessarily true. And I think he's got a good point. And I think comparing these two approaches to the extent that you put them into different categories is also a losing proposition. It's like trying to ask, what's a better tool, a wrench or a hammer? You need more information to answer the question. At its best, I think the narrative style of history actually accomplishes something that the more scholarly or clinical approach, argument-based approach, cannot achieve. It brings us closer to the way history was lived and helps bring the reader a richer, a fuller, more satisfying understanding of why and how decisions were made by those who made them. And history, whatever else it is also a genre of literature. And this has always been true. Since the ancient Greeks, Herodotus and Thucydides, Plutarch, Sallust, Tacitus, Edward Gibbon, Henry Adams, Winston Churchill, all were storytellers. Theodore Roosevelt, who was a historian of the first rank in his own right, once said something very provocative. He said he thought that the most important quality of character trait for a historian is to have imagination. It's provocative, isn't it? The idea that a historian should have imagination. We think of historians and writers of nonfiction that want to keep their imagination on a short leash, and yet the ability to put oneself into the minds of people living in the past is actually a real challenge. In my field, the book Unbroken, which is a terrific story, sold, I think, 3 or 4 million copies. And this was a story of an individual who faced really all of the horrors that war had to throw at him and came through. And it had the power of a great novel. And a story like that can act as a prism, really, to look into a subject like the Pacific War. And yet, it's very difficult for a specific story like that to really tell you that much about the whole sweep of this terrible conflict. For that, we really need big narrative histories. And I think it's rare to find narratives that can cover the vast sweep of a terrible war, but to tell that story in a narrative in which the pages keep turning. My purpose has been to assimilate into one narrative many different contrasting points of view. The American, the Allied, the Japanese perspectives, the decisions that were made at the highest levels of the political and military commands, and the view from the decks, the trenches, and the cockpits, the war on the home front. I think we have had a dearth of good narratives addressing the Pacific War and all of its vast and terrible sweep, and that's what I set out to do. This war was, by a very large margin, the largest naval war ever waged, and it was, in all likelihood, and we can hope, the largest war that naval war that will ever be waged. It was the only naval war ever to have been fought across the entire length and breadth of the Pacific, an ocean so large that you could fit all of the world's land masses into it with room to spare. It was the only instance in which opposing fleets of aircraft carriers met in battle. There were 5 such battles in the war. It provided the most complete demonstration of the means by which submarines could destroy enemy supply lines. It led to a fundamental revolution in naval doctrines, putting an end to the era of the big gun battleship and establishing carrier aviation and submarine warfare as the principal means of striking an enemy at sea. There has been a tendency, I think, axiomatic in military history to treat war on land as the main plot, war at sea as a sort of subplot. We need to invert that when we think about the Pacific War. And you only need to look at a map of the Pacific and we'll drive home the point. This was a sea war and an air war in which the fighting on land became really the specialty. And that's not to take anything away from the US Marines or the Army, the tremendous sacrifices they made on so many obscure islands in the Pacific. But taking an island, really until we got to Luzon in the Philippines, taking an island was never an end in itself. And when an island was not needed, it was simply bypassed, and its occupiers left to wither on the vine. And over the course of the war, our forces bypassed probably something on the order of 125 to 150,000 Japanese garrison troops. Who were then left there, and some of them were brought home after the war, others died, many took their own lives. But the ability to bypass islands that we did not absolutely need became a very important consideration in the second half of the war. An island was taken when it was needed as an airbase, with a coral airstrip built in the jungle, or a sea naval base with a harbor blasted out of the coral. And any big historical narrative dealing with the Pacific War, I think, must place the naval war at the spine of the narrative that actually worked in amphibious war, the striking of an enemy on land by way of sea, is the most logistically and technically complicated kind of war. Certainly it was during that era. Prior to World War II, the largest and most relevant precedent for an amphibious campaign was the Gallipoli campaign in the Dardanelles during the First World War, and this had given very little reason for confidence. By its nature, amphibious warfare requires close, sustained, intimate cooperation between the different branches of the military, between the Army, the Navy, the Marines, between air power, sea power. And by its very nature, it exposes and tends to aggravate the rivalries and the frictions between these different branches of the military. Now consider that before 1941, we had no integrated high command. We had no Joint Chiefs of Staff. That body was created as a kind of ad hoc solution to the problem that when the British came over for the first wartime summit, just 3 weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor, they had a well-oiled high command with their services represented, with the planning staff. They had been doing this for more than 2 years, and they did it very well. What we had was a Navy department and an Army or a War department, two separate co-equal cabinet departments, each headed by a civilian secretary or reported directly to the president, and no further integration at all, except for a few ad hoc committees. Our military had to learn to work together, and it was in the Pacific in particular where the great struggle between the services played out, all with the knowledge that in the post-war future there was going to be Congress was going to impose service unification, was going to fold all of this into the Department of Defense, which was created in 1947. And so to really understand how this war was fought, and you see it in the subtext in all the communications during the war, there was a game being played within the game. The Navy, the Army Air Forces, which became the Air Force, the Marines, the aviation arms, the submariners, all trying to position themselves for the post-war future, and that became an immensely important consideration in so many of these decisions. I want to leave plenty of time for questions, so I'm going to wind it up, but I just want to leave you with one last thought. And that is that this generation of leaders, World War II leaders, had all entered their careers in the first decade of the 20th century, between about 1900 and 1910. And consider what didn't exist when General MacArthur and Admiral Nimitz and Admiral King and General Marshall and all the rest of them had begun their careers. The Wright brothers got off the ground in 1903. This was when Chester Nimitz was a second-year midshipman at the Naval Academy. Our fleet was powered by coal, using the old reciprocating engines. That technology would completely change. Radio communications were in their infancy, and had, at the beginning of that first decade of the 20th century, had never been used to control ships at sea. Radar, no one had even thought of radar. No one had ever considered it was possible. All of these technologies and many more were developed over the careers of these individuals who rose to command our military forces during this largest and most devastated war in history. So it is, I think, a tribute to the quality of that leadership that they were able to assimilate and incorporate all of that change in the course of their careers and to use it very effectively in the war against the Axis. So I'll close there. I'd be happy to take any questions. it's really extraordinary that all these years later, you still really have within the landscape of historians and biographers, you really have, this guy has his ability to divide people, you still have his camps. MacArthur was, one of the things that we asked of our generals, of our leaders, our military leaders, what do we ask of them? We ask that they have brains, we ask that they have courage. MacArthur was absolutely brilliant, first in his class at West Point, throughout his entire career, conspicuously brilliant. And he had extraordinary personal courage, and he proved that many times in his career, particularly during the First World War. He led his troops on the field and exposed himself to enemy fire in a way that I think was very rare among officers of his rank. He and his Southwest Pacific Area staff, I think, had performed very well, I think, in the South Pacific campaign. Some of that credit should go to his sub-commanders, his number two, Richard Sutherland, his air commander, George Kenney, and his naval commanders, but the man at the top gets credit for the performance of the organization and the South Pacific campaign, to answer your question specifically, between 1942 and 1944, was deftly planned and well executed. And so I think no one gets to take that away from those MacArthur. He had a very good record as a military commander in the Second World War, putting aside all of the other many controversies associated with his birth. Yes.
I have a question, which is, in your research in 1945, did the Japanese ever catch up to us on radar? Because that radar, I served in the Pacific for 2 years in 44, 44, 45 on a heavy cruiser, let's call it, which had, in the course of 3 years, 301 casualties out of a crew of 1,000. And so although we saw action all through those months, I served in Combat Information Center where we had these fighting boards. And that was incredibly helpful for the kamikaze attacks, especially.
Top of Okinawa.
Yeah, Okinawa, yeah. Yeah. And even Iwo Jima we had, too.
Well, that's fascinating. I'd love to talk to you some more about that. No, they never came close to our Ministry of Radar, either the technology itself or our ability to use it. They were well behind. They had, probably overall, I think the quality of their radar in 1945 would have been no better than ours was in 1942.
Okay.
And in general, that was true, I think, down the line with their technology. They were just a little bit behind in some areas, but that combined with the tremendous pressures they had from our bombing, from the destruction of their seaborne supply lines, made it really impossible. It's extraordinary what they did achieve when you think about the constraints that they had. But in general, the Japanese, in all of these areas of technology, fell behind.
Except in Tokyo, there's a better knowledge.
Yes, at the outset of the war, absolutely.
Yes.
And their torpedoes is a good example of a technology where we struggled to catch up right up to the end of the war. Another one, not as well, doesn't receive as much attention, but their flying boats, their reconnaissance planes, were excellent. Even at the end of the war, compared very well to ours. So when you consider that this country was an isolated, feudal East Asian country, really until the last couple of decades, 3 or 4 decades of the 19th century, I think that really in the space of about one long human life, what they were able to achieve, it is pretty remarkable.
You mentioned at the beginning, say, that the World War II shows democracies versus fascists. Democracies prevail.
Yeah.
Two questions on that one. Dealing with Washington.
Yes.
And their contribution. And secondly, I remember in Lionel Hart's book, he starts off in the history of World War II saying, where are the important resources. And his conclusion was, well, that the Axis powers would just ultimately run out of material.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think, you know, a lot of it comes down to, you know, the industrial base in the Ruhr versus the upper Midwest of the United States. These two different industrial bases comparing their potentialities. And in some ways, you can look at the war and you can reduce it to that. It's instructive to do that. But there was another very significant difference between the industrial base of Germany and that of the United States, and that is one was completely beyond the reach of enemy bombers or armies. You're not the first one to raise that objection to my point with Russia and the Soviet Union. And yes, of course, the Red Army really destroyed the German army. Did 90% of the work in destroying the Red Army. They did that with a lot of help, particularly material support in this country. And certainly the extraordinary triumph of the Soviets over the Germans in that by far largest and most cataclysmic ground war history was, you know, one of the reasons that communism had quite a bit of prestige throughout the world in the early part of the Cold War, and why it took almost 50 years really for that model to collapse in its own way. Much bigger issue, but very interesting. Yes, sir.
Understanding how the knowledge of the atomic bombs production is being thought about as being developed. Did that have any impact on the strategy and the actual fighting of the Soviet war?
Well, very little, for a couple of reasons. One is that this was one of the, so the question was, if you didn't hear, was did the knowledge that we had the Manhattan Project and that we might have an atomic bomb play into decisions that were made in the last year of the Pacific War? And the answer is very little. And the reason is because this was one of the most closely guarded secrets of the war, the Manhattan Project. And so the circle of people who knew that we were building this weapon was very small. And secondly, because no one really knew whether it would work. And that was especially true in 1944. Admiral William Leahy, who was the de facto chairman of the Joint Chiefs and was really Roosevelt's right hand during that period of the war, was adamant that it wasn't going to work. And of course, he was really talking through his hat because he wasn't a physicist, but he was an explosives expert. He said, this is all nonsense, it's not going to work. And so really, I think that the atomic bomb did not become a significant consideration in terms of highest level decision making really until July 1945. Before that, it was just a sort of a potential, something that might become important if it worked. And even then, it wasn't clear how or when we would use it. The important decisions about the atomic bomb were made really in a rush, essentially in the weeks before it was gone.
Yes. I noticed one of the fascinating things about the first two volumes to me was that you give a very even-handed treatment of the Japanese side as well. Very human interest, and I'm curious as to whether you're going to carry that through in the third volume as well. And also, I was curious: were there new archives or information available to you more recently when you wrote your book, as opposed to older historians' accounts?
That's specifically with regard to Japan or over
Japan, yes.
Yeah. I have always been fascinated with Japan, and in general, I don't read Japanese, but there has been a surge in translations of Japanese histories, of oral history collections, collections of letters, various primary sources which have become available in English in the past 15 to 20 years. And so my approach really has been to try to mine those somewhat comprehensively to try to partly make up for the fact that I can't read the language. And in general, I have been fascinated with the Japanese experience of the war, and we'll go into that in much deeper detail in the third volume as well. I did live in Japan as a child, between the ages of 11 and 14, and in those formative years, you grow attached to the place where you live, regardless of where it is. So Tokyo, for me, feels like home, even if I travel there now. And part of the reason I got interested in this subject was that we, our country, burned my neighborhood down about 35 years before I lived there. And so the memory of that war is extraordinarily bitter even today. And I would have thought that, given that 75 years ago, with time, maybe some of these feelings would have begun to fade a bit. If anything, they seem to maybe be getting stronger, which is not a good sign. And of course, it's not just this country. It's also China and Korea and the Philippines. And so this will be interesting to see whether the ghosts of World War II continue to haunt Japan and our relationship with Japan and Japan's place in East Asia in the future. One of the principles and the themes that I try to weave into my work is that the militarist tyranny that took control of that country during what they call their Dark Valley period, 1930 to the end of the war, they made victims out of the Japanese people. So the Japanese people were, in a sense, victims as well as perpetrators during that conflict. Yes, sir.
Sir, in your opinion, what gave the Japanese decision makers the hope or the idea that they could take on the United States?
You know, they essentially had a decision-making system that was malfunctioning very, very badly. And this is really what plunged them into the Dark Valley period. In right around 1930, the government system that they had set up during the Meiji period, under the Meiji Constitution, which had been represented as a gift by the Meiji Emperor to the Japanese people, contained within it significant flaws, which empowered the military in a very dangerous way. It allowed them essentially to grind the business of government to a complete halt. And the army in particular, rather factions within the Japanese army, began to exploit these mechanisms in a way that essentially allowed them to gain complete control over the country in 1930. By 1940, 1941, when this decision to strike the United States and Britain was made, you had a complete breakdown of anything resembling a rational national decision-making process. You had mid-level officers, particularly in the Army and also the Navy, linked to one another through factions, who were manipulating the decisions of their superior officers. And so in a sense, within the military services of Japan, you had fake ranks and real ranks. You had generals who were not really generals. You had captains and majors who were really generals, who were making decisions with the constant threat of violence and assassination. Anyone who got in their way would simply be shot dead. And this is a long and complicated story, which I deal with in a good deal of detail, in the first volume of this trilogy. But essentially, you had a deadlock between the Army and the Navy having to do with control of natural resources and budget funds. And this deadlock could only be resolved by giving both the Army and Navy what they wanted. What the Navy wanted was to go south and solve their oil problem by taking the Dutch East Indies. And the Army wanted to continue and expand their war in China. Of course, this made no sense. Many of the leaders in Tokyo knew it made no sense, and warned that it made no sense. And yet, due to perhaps a failure of moral courage, they, in order to avert a civil war in Japan, essentially said, we'll do this. We'll roll the dice and we'll do the best.
Was there any German support of Japan technologically when they were struggling to develop things like that?
Very rarely. The question was, did the Nazi Germans provide technical support to Japan? There was some support provided before the war. There was some consulting, in particular the field of aviation. But in general, the Axis partners were allies only in name, really in name only. And there was virtually no real coordination between the Nazi Germany and Japan.
And also, were the other allied nations at all involved?
Well, the British positions essentially collapsed very quickly in the beginning of the war. And the Japanese took Malaya and Singapore in mid-February, among the 10 weeks after the attack on Pearl Harbor. This was, I think, British historians will agree that this was the worst defeat in British military history. Essentially, there are many different reasons for that. Long story, but essentially they had their hands full in Europe. And so once the British were knocked out of Malaya and Hong Kong and Burma, then by and large all they could do was try to hold on to India. And so that's basically what happened. They did fight a valorous campaign to recapture Burma. But there was little they could do. And in the last year of the war, of course, Churchill wanted a role for Great Britain in the final defeat of Japan, particularly a role for the Royal Navy. And this became essentially a complex sort of diplomatic problem because our Navy didn't really saw the British as only getting in the way at that point. And yet the decision was made that we opened the role. And so we provided it for
the standpoint of people in the ship. We didn't want the British with our war.
And they hadn't mastered the logistical complexities of staying at sea as you did.
Thank you. I never understood why we took places like Anamita, Tarawa, Helen, and I still don't. We seem to say that they made use of these.
Yeah, well, you know, the three islands you named, I think they could have bypassed two. They could have bypassed Tarawa, and probably should have. Definitely should have bypassed Palawan, which was tremendous bloodshed for no good reason. Anamitok was a useful fleet base out of the Mid-Pacific. But these decisions were made, of course, without the knowledge that we have now. And in many cases came down to a judgment that we had to deny the Japanese the airstrip that each of these islands had, because it would be a thorn in the side of our fleet. As the war developed, it very quickly became apparent that our command in the air was so great that we could bypass a place like Palau or Tarawa, even though there was an airstrip there. And then just suppress Japanese air power with regular bombing runs and fire strikes. And so these lessons were learned. In some cases, they were learned a little too late. And a lot of young Marines paid with their lives.
Thank you.
entire campaign, in a sense, was predicated on an ultimate invasion of Japan, right? Which never happened. So it's at least ironic so much blood was spilled on those islands. But I want to raise a question about the dropping of the bomb. I did a little research for work on my father's experience in the movement cell. He was on Barbie's flagship, who was the leading theorist in his work. Okay. My dad always thought that the invasion was going to happen, and he was going to be a Catholic, so he was in favor of the bomb being dropped. Whether or not he was right. In my research, I learned that, in fact, Operation Olympic was taken off the table in 1945 because it was deemed too bloody an option to pursue. Because we had intercepts of the Japanese secret radio intercepts that showed their positions on Kyushu being overwhelmed. So if my sources are correct, the American public was essentially duped into believing that Operation Olympic was the alternative to dropping the bomb.
Yeah. Well, it's a big subject. You know, Operation Olympic, the invasion of Kyushu, was never formally taken off the table. It had been ordered with an invasion date of November 1st. Whether or not it was going to happen is a much different question, and the views of many of our military leaders, particularly our Navy leaders, was that it was not necessary to invade Japan, that planning would progress so that you had the option and all of the logistics would be prepared for this invasion, so that the option was there. But you could have all of the preparations in place. You could have the troops ready to go. You could have all the logistics set up. And on October 31st, the President of the United States could say, we're not going to go. So the preparations were certainly proceeded. And I believe that we would have invaded Kyushu if it became clear that there was no other alternative. As to your point that there has been a myth, if I can represent it, you said that way, there's been a myth that there was a categorical or binary choice between dropping the bomb without warning on a Japanese city or invading Kyushu. I agree with you. I think that that is a myth, that Truman was confronted with either one or the other of those options. There were a range of other options. And I think it's important to remember that the target date of the invasion was November 1st, and the first bomb was dropped on August 6th, so that's quite a long time. That's quite a bit of time in which something else could have happened. What else would have happened? The Japanese were going to be facing mass famine in the fall of 1945. We knew that, and their leadership knew that. The Soviet Union was going to declare war on Japan by, quote-unquote, mid-August. This pledge had been made to us by Stalin. We knew that that was going to happen. The Japanese didn't know until it actually happened on August 9th. And we knew that that event was going to shock the Japanese and might change the deadlock in the ruling circle of Tokyo. So there were certainly reasons to believe that a bloodless surrender could have been achieved prior to November 1st. And that was the conclusion of Paul Mitzel, who wrote the Strategic Bombing Survey after the war. So this is a big, complicated subject. And we're dealing with uncertainties and what might have been. And it's not the sort of subject where you can, I think, make a sweeping conclusion. Considering all of the work that I've done, my view is that I would have preferred an explicit warning to be given to the Japanese. I think that would have been a somewhat more defensible personally, having met and befriended a number of World War II veterans, I have a strong sense of wanting to be deferential to that point of view.
Well, you know, but in considering that, don't you have to take into account that when the bomb was dropped by Hiroshima, Japan refused to surrender. Then the second bomb was dropped by Nagasaki. They wanted to surrender only the conditions. And there were many in the military and many in society that still wanted to hold out. So if you consider all of that they were still holding out, then you query how long would they hold out until they starve to death?
Yeah, and that's unknown. And that's tough. But
would they ever surrender?
You know, on the other hand, when you say that they wouldn't surrender, that's true. And yet, you had extraordinary turmoil happening within the Japanese regime. And part of the reason that it was so difficult for them to surrender, even after two bombs had been dropped, was because there were real fears, well-founded fears, that what would happen in Japan was a complete breakdown in the control of that country, leading really to the Civil War. And so one of the aspects, I think, that has been somewhat neglected in the way that we remember the war is that Japan was really on the verge of just completely falling into raising up arms against each other in a general civil war between various factions within the military. And so part of what that small circle of people around the emperor, military leaders, were trying to do was figure out how do we come in for a soft landing here without a complete breakdown of control, which in the end would have probably required an invasion on our part as well.
And last thing I'm going to say, but there are many instances in history where a stronger force lost because the people lost the political will. It would be an American Revolution. England lost the political will to fight. The war in Europe was over. All those people were coming home. I mean, I would think that the political will to continue to fight in Japan for maybe years until they finally surrendered might have dissipated. And I think that's what the Japanese may have thought, is that eventually America would lose the political will to continue to fight and pursue for peace and would, you know, would leave some of the military in charge. And maybe they'd have other things.
Yeah. Well, certainly was their hope. Certainly they were hoping that war fatigue would allow them to negotiate some sort of deal. So that is the case. And again, my point of view, I think, is that about the bomb is that we had the war board. What our country accomplished in World War II is something that we can all be really proud of. And it's very rare in history that you can look back and say, well, that war, there were the good guys and the bad guys. Not as that common to say that. World War II was clear. The good guys were. We were good guys. What we achieved is something that we can take lasting pride in. And we created a post-war order founded upon principles of democracy and self-determination. We stood up to the Soviet Union and won that conflict over 45 years. And so, you know, I tend to think of these things in terms of a narrative. And I feel that with the way that the bomb was used, that it was not necessary to avert a bloody invasion, in my view. Well, of course, there's a lot of uncertainty because it's the alternative path that wasn't taken. And that given all that we had achieved and all of the blood that had been shed, you didn't want to mess up the masterpiece with the last stroke of the brush. And in a sense, what I think is very personal is that Truman sort of messed up this masterpiece that the argument came by using the bomb in a way that was not necessary. And I told you I lived in Japan as a boy, and so some of this is personal. certainly I believe that if confronted with the choice of a bloody invasion or using the bomb the way we used it, if those really were the only two choices, I would take them.
Isn't it true that General MacArthur and his staff ignored the warning from Washington that the Japanese were going to invade, and as a result, most of his planes were wiped out?
It is true, yeah. He actually knew about that we'd been attacked at Pearl Harbor. It happened on the same day. So because of the time zone change, they had, I think, 9 hours of notice between the time that Pearl Harbor was attacked and the bombers and fighters from the Tainan Air Base in Formosa arrived at our Clark Field in Luzon, caught our B-17s on the ground and wiped out about half of the Army Air Force's air power on the, in the Philippines on the first day of the war. A failure which really is inexplicable even to this day, and MacArthur would never call to account for it. And certainly that's one of those disparities that I think it's very hard to explain that in any way other than by referring to the extraordinary popularity of MacArthur with the American people and the way that the first weeks of the war were presented in the American press. It's very instructive to go through the process of reading about the first 4 months of the war, week by week, just reading the press accounts in the New York Times, Time Magazine, etc., and not referring to anything else you know from history. It provides an illuminating alternative view in which MacArthur is really seen as an extraordinary and heroic figure.
Yeah, but that's the way you presented him earlier.
That's what I did?
Yes. You talked about what a great staff he had, what a great general he was, how he did everything right, and he actually had feet of clay.
Right. Now, that's absolutely true. And if I'd taken more time on that question, I would have given you the dirt on the I'll get into that much more in my the after sign books.
I'm sorry?
That was my question. Thank you very much.
Oh, that was your question, too?
It's a joke in my household. Every time I start a new book about World War II, and consider it just fairly frequently, I say to my husband, I'm reading Bob Black, he gets him, he thinks he's a fool, and he goes, MacArthur, because like every author, they all say, what is the deal with that?
Well, how did